If someone were to ask you if you were a motivator, what would you say? Are you a motivator? Are you able to motivate people? And we've talked about these two characteristics of knowing where you're going and then getting other people to go with you. And so before you can be an effective motivator in God's sight or in God's direction, it must not be of the flesh, but it must be of the Spirit. So we need to know where we're going and then bringing other people along as God would have us to do that. The first step in knowing where we're going is that we must in our own life become highly infectious. A leader is a man who has a real disease. He's a carrier. Wherever he goes, he spreads contagion. And that is the spiritual infection that God has put in his life. And this is the thing that gets you caught up in the life of Paul. Brother, he was tremendously effective and infected. And wherever he went, he affected other people. It just, those spiritual germs just spilled out of his life. Intense interpersonal relationships, and you got around him and got close. What happens when you have something infectious? You have a cold or you have a fever. You say, "Don't get close to me." Well, you want to stay away from people. But when you have something you want to infect someone with, and you want to affect them with that infection for God's sake, you get close. And this is where we get drawn in an interpersonal relationship. Are you threatened? Will you let somebody come so close to you? Certain young people, some come so close to you. Certain adults come so close. Your wife comes so close to you. Or your husband comes so close to you. No farther. And there are some things in there that we're not at peace about. Or that we're not at rest about. And an infectious person is somebody that's willing to let someone get inside them and with them. The closer you are to a person, the greater potential of infection. That is, if you've got something really that's real to infect that person with. There's a marvelous passage of Scripture in John chapter 4 that talks to us about the infectious nature of the gospel. And you all are familiar with this, about the woman of Samaria and the Lord's encounter with her at the well. And she wanted to get him embroiled in theological discussion. And there again, be careful in your ministry. You know, they'll have people that want to ask you why and where and get into. We always come back to the practical relating of God's Word to their life. And Jesus just brought her back to the real critical insight of who He was. I'm the one speaking to you. I'm the Messiah. I'm the person that you're looking for. And so then His disciples come back after He's talked to this woman and He revealed Himself to her. And knew all about her life. And they said that they couldn't understand why I spent time with a Jewish woman. They couldn't understand why I hadn't eaten. And the woman left and she went back into the city. And what did she do when she got back to the city? She motivated a group of men to come and see what she had seen. You see? And here was Jesus in that brief time infected her and brought her to the point of motivation where she went back in the city and said, "Come see a man that told me everything I ever did." And so there are his disciples, still thinking on the natural realm. Well, Lord, who gave you something to eat? I haven't had anything to eat. My meat, my sustenance, and that literally means the thing that sustains me is doing the will of God. And you know, that's why we really can do without more sleep than we realize. We can do without more food than we realize. If we're in the center of God's will, if we're really doing what God wants us to do. And so I ask you a question this morning. What really infects you? Is it ambition? Is it pride? Is it fear? Or is it the infectious nature of Jesus Christ wanting to reproduce Him in the lives of other people? So she discovered, along with others, that Jesus was infectious and she brought people to Him. There is something tremendously drawing about people that have an infectious spirit. If you've ever read Spurgeon's sermon notes to his students, there's an illustration there of a young man that came and said, "Sir, I've seen your ministry and I've watched what happens and I've seen the crowds that come and all the things and everything and I want you to share with me how I can have that kind of ministry." And you remember Spurgeon saying, "Young man, just in essence, just set yourself on fire and people will come to watch you burn." Mm-hmm. And so here is Spurgeon in a flame of being infectious to all those that have come to know the Lord. Now, have you ever gotten close to someone that when you found out they were more image than they were substance? Have you seen people that seem to be so good, so neat, you know, use good modern terminology, boy, they are so neat, they are so attractive, they've really got it all together. But when you get close to them, you realize that's a facade and a shell. That's why when people come to me from time to time and phone me and write me almost every week about somebody on the staff, and you know, I'm not nearly so concerned about the image that they project as how well they wear. You know, it's how well they wear, what they are there, not the first flush of the program, not the first excitement of what goes on, but how well do they wear. When you really get inside, the farther you get inside and peel back those layers of truth and meaning and substance, you know, in their life. And so it's kind of like, you wouldn't know this unless you've been on a farm, but if you've ever watched a calf nurse, there's a lot of froth and a lot of foam. It's kind of like calf slobbers. There's a lot of bubbles. And, you know, there are a lot of people that are that way. There's really not much substance to their life. And God would have us to really have substance to their life. Be an infectious person, and that disease has gone all the way into our spirit. Now, those are the kind of people that we ought to be willing to go anywhere at any time to find that kind of infectious spirit. You see? Did you hear what Ralph said the other night? He said, I have gone at my own expense across the country to spend time with someone that would infect me with something good and something right. And that's so important as young men. I asked one of the most successful pastors one time in the Southern Baptist Convention, what was the secret of God moving through his life? You know what he told me? He said, as a young man, he said, I attached myself to other people that were succeeding in areas in which I knew God wanted me to succeed and were right and good. I stayed around them. I listened to them. I didn't impose on them, but I wanted to be with them. And, you know, as young men, so many times you go to a meeting or something, you might want to be with one another, but let me challenge you. You ought to be sitting at a table with somebody, listening to what they have to say, standing around a group, listening to what those people have to say, to really catch this infectious spirit. And then there's a second way in which we can persuade others to go along with us, and that's by seeing other individuals in terms of their potential. And here again, we're reasoning God's ways against our ways. We tend to see only in terms of what someone is and not what God can help them to become. I think that every Christian ought to pray and ask God to help me discern, to develop the gift of discernment. Very few of us are discerning people. I didn't say a judgmental person. I didn't say a person that, all right, reads somebody and then builds a wall and shuts them off or categorizes them, but a discerning person, discerning the potential that's in the individual and where they are. Now, you begin to think about Jesus' disciples, and you ask yourself a question. Would you have chosen those 12 men that Jesus chose? Well, of course not. We look at them and say, man, you know. And I'll be frank with you. I look at myself and I say, Lord, I don't believe I'd have chosen me. Unless you get too pious, I don't think I'd have chosen you. You know, we look at one another, and there are very few of us say, well, listen, I'd like to, I think you're one of them that's going to be a world changer. But Jesus understood the potential in the life of individuals. And I think one of the ways he did that, of course, was by prayer. And I believe that Jesus observed these men. I believe Jesus had been by the seashore. I believe he'd walked by Levi's table. I believe he'd watched him. And there again, learning the characteristics of individuals, knowing that if you've got a point of discrepancy in your life or disarrangement in your personality, a nitpicker, somebody that's very critical, that's just the wrong side of a positive characteristic. It could be that that person has a tremendous spirit of attentiveness and alertness to detail that God could use for good. You see, and when his life is changed, we're looking at the backside of that, at the bad side of it. And God has a good side to every one of those characteristics. And after all, the Lord is looking for available people. I have observed that generally those are the most talented and the most talented and the most qualified and the most that have the most to offer that the world sees them usually are not available. They are locked in into their own lifestyle, to their own values, to their own systems, and usually we cannot get that person over into the realm of spiritual things. That's why God so many times begins on the humble beginnings. And that's the great challenge, for instance, in a mission field. You go and the thing that you ask somebody, man, let's reach the upper class. Let's reach the upper class. We've reached the riffraff too long. Let's reach the upper class. Oh, we've had a tremendous conflict in many of our mission fields. Let's get a building. Let's get a program. Let's get a strategy that's going to grab these top people. Now, I made some observations. In going into work and starting new work, many times God, not man, but God will find one person like us, that is a Lydia. You see? You know what happened to Philip? One person that's a Lydia. And God has to select that person. But He'll have many people that are like the Philippian jailer. And many people that are like the demon-possessed girl. And God begins where people are. And out of that, there evolutes, or there comes out in God's process of evolution and revolution in their life, those people that are going to be the spiritual leaders. And this is a big challenge so many times. Rather than growing that, we want to impose what's taken centuries to develop in Christian life here in America, and we want to immediately impose that on the mission field. Well, we'll have a hospital, or we'll have a full-blown youth center, or we'll have this, or we'll have a BSU program, or we'll have some other things that have taken a long time to generate. So God is always looking for the available person. And when He finds that available person, He'll be willing to use that. And you know, in our so many times in our ministry, there are a number of people standing around that never have the courage to step forward and volunteer, but desperately they want someone to ask them to do this, to draw them in and say, you can do it. I'll help you do it. I'll train you to do it. You know, one thing that I'm trying to do more and more and more is to deal with people on an individual basis. If here's a woman that needs to be won to the Lord and somebody passes this on to me, instead of me going and doing it every time, I'll say, Lord, who can minister to that person? And when God gives me a name, I'll phone that person up, I'll explain the situation, I'll say, would you please go down there for me and deal with that person and then share with me what happened? And you know, I had a couple tell me the other day that went to a home and won a woman to the Lord that was in dire circumstances and at the end of her rope. And they won her to the Lord. They had her in church. She's come and made her profession of faith. And the other night, they thanked me. They said, we are so grateful that you asked us to do that. We're thrilled that you phoned us and thought about us and asked us to do that. It just really excites us. Well, there again, look for available people. The third thing is by mastering the art of developing men. And there's a difference in manipulating people and in developing people. All the difference in the world. When you develop a person, you're looking for his maximum potential. Now, even those that study human physiology and psychology tell us that we operate on just a fraction of our potential. Did you know that the average person, intelligent, educated, uses about 10% of his brain capacity, of what he can do? An athlete, they are extended and they're growing because we realize that there is no limit. There's basically a psychological barrier. For instance, the 4-minute mile. It wasn't because people couldn't run that fast. It was because we just thought nobody can ever run that fast. You see, there's just no way that the human body can do that. And when we realized that we had that capacity and we extended ourselves and realized that people could be trained towards their maximum capacity, all sorts of things have happened. We just see things happen all the time. Now, you know, always somebody say, well, hey, you know, that's great if you got these multi-talented people, but I've got this one-cylinder young person. All he's got is one cylinder. Thum, 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 thum. He just functions on that one cylinder. And, okay, then if he's just got one cylinder, let him use it, get him, encourage him to develop it to his maximum, you see, to his maximum. We've got a fellow in our church. He's had cerebral palsy when he was a child, still has it, of course, to that degree. And Bill is a little bit spastic that way, and his wife has the same thing. Now, they were raised in different homes. He was raised in a very prominent home in the city of Fort Worth. He has a twin sister. He was hidden by his family. And then when he was let do something, they did everything for him or said, Bill, you cannot do that. You can't do that. You can't do that. As a result, he grew up course, with a terrible self-image, thinking he couldn't do anything. His wife was raised on a farm in Texas by very simple Christian people who immediately, when she came home weeping from that withered hand and that crippled leg and that drawn face on that side, and children had thrown stones at her and called her names, her parents didn't bring her in and seclude her and comfort her. They said, "Pat, we're sorry that this has happened to you in your life. But you know, God has a reason and a purpose, and you're going to be with this way all your life. And you can either get in your room and lock the door and become like an old sick animal, or else you can face it and make something." She learned to drive a tractor. She plays the organ. She plays the piano. There's nothing she doesn't think she has to do the driving. Her husband will not do the driving because he was raised without him understanding that he should be developed to his potential. Now, what can Bill do in a church? You know what Bill does? I asked him, I said, "Bill, I want you to do something for me." He said, "Great." I said, "On Wednesday night, I want you to take these prayer sheets and stand at the door and pass them out to everybody. And if you miss anybody, go over to that table and give them." Well, that might seem such a simple thing to you, but that's the highlight of that fellow's week. You see, now he works, he makes a nominal living, his wife makes most of their living, she's an expert bookkeeper. But old Bill, "Brother, I want you to know every Wednesday night he's there. And there he is, handing out those papers. He's only got one cylinder. But we want to develop it to the capacity." Now, let's say you've got somebody that's got 12 cylinders. Then don't let that person be satisfied to operate on 10 cylinders. You see, challenge the maximum in a person's life. Young man that's working with our college and career department is a master at this. With love, incisively, just laying out before a young person in a one-on-one conversation what his capacity is and saying, "Now let me ask you a question. Do you think you're living up here to capacity?" "Well, do you care what I think?" "Well, sure, what do you think?" "I think you're not living up here to capacity." See? And so I'm just sharing with you, this is what God wants to do with you. This is what He can. Now, listen, don't come back in a couple of years and say, "Listen, Mike, if somebody had just shared with me, I'm sharing with you what your capacity is and what God wants you to do." So, you know, I have learned from bitter experience that my primary task is to minister to a man and not recruit him for a task. I am to minister to that person and not recruit him for a task. I am not to manipulate him or to use him in any way. There are three principles that John Wooten uses. And, of course, nobody has approached his record, either as a coach and very few coaches as a man. But he sets forth in his book the three principles of a winning team. And these are things that we can apply in our spiritual life. He says, "These are things that I attempt to do in the practice of trying to develop men." First of all, he says, he gets the team in condition. And of course, if you've been listening, if you're a follower of football, you would hear Tom Landry say, and you would hear these Dallas Cowboys say, the reason we're where we are at 7-0 and have come on in the fourth quarter is because of an off-season conditioning program. When the game wasn't on, to be conditioned, you know, we get so caught up in what happens. I happened to train under Coach Eddie Hurt, who at one time was recognized as one of the 5 outstanding track coaches in the United States. And we had a tremendous track team for those years. And I can hear him say again and again, "Fellas, the race is not won on Saturday. The race is won when you came to school and it was hot summertime and all of us who were sprinters or quarter milers or everything else began to run cross country. We ran it in the sweltering heat. We ran it in the snow. I've run 5, 6, 7, 8 miles with a towel around my face and a complete sweatsuit, icicles hanging down. You see, in the wintertime, long time off from the thrill of the race and breaking the tape and the medals and the trophies and the trips and all that." So conditioning is so very, very important. Not only what goes on in a game, but what goes on between games. You know, people are beginning to understand that you can't have a lackadaisical practice. If it's a real sharp coach, brother, he makes that practice under game conditions because you will play like you practice. You see? So this gets into your leisure life, into your social life, into every area of your life. You can't let down. See? You have to have the same things. And Coach Wooden said, "I find that a man can tear down much faster than I can ever build up." Isn't that the truth? Brother, you get them all jacked up and next week they're all down and by the time you see them again. So what goes on between the conditioning? A second point is that he said, teach them the fundamentals or the basics. Now I have a sermon that I have prepared, and I've used that thing and probably got more reaction from it than any message I've ever preached. And the name of it is Life Without Miracles. And I just took it from the scripture where the Bible talked about John the Baptist and said there's never been a greater person born among women, among men, than John the Baptist. And yet it says, and yet John did no miracle. Now what did he do? When you look at the life of John the Baptist, he stuck to the basics. You know, he stuck to the basics. And when you look at what makes somebody successful, probably the most successful football coach we've ever had has been Vince Lombardi. You know what he said? Football consists of blocking and tackling and carrying the ball. Three principles. And he would have those men run those plays. They only had five basic plays in their repertoire. And they ran those things over and over and over, and those fellas would get to the point of anguish, but they went over and over and over those things. You see, the basics. So we're talking about the basics. I say so many times in talking to preachers and people like that, staff members, that so many times we as Baptist religious workers have the turkey complex. Turkeys are one of the dumbest animals in the world. You know that? They are followers, and yet they go. In other words, I never will forget one time Martha Brannon came from a little town of Dustin. Martha Brannon's a solo. Some of you might know him. Martha and I were in school together, and I was in a revival meeting one time in Dustin, Oklahoma. And they have a lot of turkey farms there. And so I was talking to this fellow, and he was telling me how dumb turkeys were. He said, you know, last week, he said, I lost over 30 turkeys because I made a mistake of feeding them. I brought a barrel out and emptied it out and left it and turned my back. One turkey ran up there, flew up there and to see what was in the barrel, got overbalanced and fell in. He said, before I could turn around, 30 other turkeys flew up to that barrel, fell inside, and smothered one another to death because that turkey was in there. You know. Now, we've got the, really, we have the turkey complex. Boy, if anything, if we hear of anything going on, we run over there and say, boy, I've got to have that program. I've got that. What are you doing? You know, whether it's what God meant us to do or not. See? Instead of saying, Lord, what is my program? And there are refinements, and there are things that we can do. And we ought to learn, and you ought to have a learner's heart, and you ought to gather information, but there's no substitute for the basics. You see, we were sharing, coming up here, Steve and I, in so many times getting out with pastors and other people, they go to all the conferences, they learn all the stuff, and I go to them and say, what are you doing? Well, you know, I've heard that. But are you doing it? Are you doing any of it? Have you put any of it to practice in your life? No. And we just go and ever learning. The Bible talks about people ever learning. Back to the basics. Do you have these things in your life? Do you have a simple, basic program in your ministry? Never mind about the spectaculars. You know, work with the basics, and that's what made the bomb so effective with the Packers. Is that you see they ran the basics, and all of a sudden here old boy Dollar went down the middle and Bart Starr hit him with a touch. They did that again and again and again because they stuck at the basics, you see, and they didn't play for the long bomb every time. Well, how about your youth program? How about your leadership leading? Are you playing for the long bomb, the spectacular, the something that nobody else is doing? Or have you got a little group of people and are you going through the basics? So the basics. Now, there's a third principle that Coach Wooden talked about, and that's to get your men to work together as a team and not as individuals. And, you know, that is so important, not because I said it or someone else said it before me, but because when you study the ministry of Christ, that's what you see in the life of Jesus. You know, you recruit individuals, but you train teams. You recruit individuals, but you train teams. And have you ever thought about the fact, certainly, you remember one place in the Word, it says that, and many other things did Jesus so that all the books in the world couldn't hold all these things. So we don't know what all Jesus did. But what we do know is almost everything Jesus ever said to an individual, he said it when there were other people around. Have you ever thought about that? See? There were times, surely, that somebody got him off, but Jesus always dealt with groups. He worked as a team, and we've got to get into this thing of a team. And he said that the fourth thing is that the means of becoming a motivator of men is by being a self-starter in your own life. Now, your greatest problem, fellas and ladies, just like mine is not somebody else. It's not the preacher. It's not the program. It's not the church. The greatest problem that I have in my life is me. See? I never will forget one time hearing a tape, and this guy was relating, this was years ago, he was relating to motivation and how we get stirred up, and he was talking about salesmen and how they go to these motivational meetings, and you have a Zig Ziglar or you have somebody else, and they get all these salesmen in there, brother, and he starts in. And I don't know if you've ever been to those things, but listen, man, they get like a revival meeting. Man, they get so fired up that they open the door and they just run over the bench top. Boy, to get out, they're going out there going to sell $1,050,000, you know, on and on. And he related that to religious things about how, you know, we come and brother, we hear all this and we say, I'm going to win the world. I'm going to touch my town for Jesus. And I get so excited and I rush home and I jump out there on Monday morning and I get my prospect list right there beside me, that file, get it in the seat, and I put the key in the starter, and the who me syndrome gets me. You know. I'm going to win the town. I'm going to win all, who, me? You know. With my pastor? With my youth program? With the people I have to work with? And the who me syndrome he talked about hits you. And so the biggest problem we've got of getting motivated and started is us. It's not somebody else. It's getting us started. It's a marvelous insight and ability to stay away from people that demotivate you. You know who those people are? You ought to put them down in your mind and graciously stay away people. Stay away from people that can defuse you. Boy, I can get around some people that can deflate me quicker than anything in the world. Boy, I just, before I leave, you know, oh yeah, I tried that. Yeah. You know, that's not too good idea. Or I know somebody did that and it didn't work out for them. And boy, you got all these neat ideas, and before you know it, man, you're just wrung out. Every bit of motivation you had is gone. Boy, avoid those people like the plague. But on the other hand, go anywhere to get with somebody that will, in a practical way, and not with frenzy or froth, but with God's, in, you know what the word enthusiasm means? It means God in you. See? That's what the word enthusiasm means. Enthu. God in you. And that sort of enthusiasm, if you know somebody that has it, brother, I'd go and get with them from time to time. I've got a dear friend that's pastor of the Cassaview Baptist Church. We were missionaries together in the Philippines. And we try at least once a month and more often than that to get together at noon with our wives. Because, listen, he enthuses me. We are frank about problems and the needs of our church. But when I get through, I'm enthused about God's work. That's the kind of person I need to be around, you see. So be a self-starter. Now, let me say just a word here about balance. And you've heard someone say, and I think Bill Gothard originated it, but if there was an 11th commandment that God would have given, it would have been this: thou shalt have balance in your spiritual life. Balance is one of the most difficult things in the world to obtain, and balance is a direct relation, in direct proportionship and relationship to our spiritual maturity. Being able to know the mind and the will, let your moderation be known to all men. Now, what I'm talking about balance here is the danger of having too much or too little control in the life of an individual. In other words, we either smother someone to death or we don't give them enough sustenance and strength, and they wither away, or they become spiritually unnourished and emotionally unnourished and other things, and they never make it. And there again, that comes through discernment and through the mind and through the will of God, knowing what we ought to do. I share this with you, and I don't think Bill would mind me sharing this with you. In a personal conversation he shared with me, he said, you know, he said the other day, he said, I had one of our staff members uncover one of the most startling blind spots to my life that I've ever seen. And he said in a conversation, when he asked for insight, one of the fellows on his staff said, well, Bill, it seems to me that in your desire as an exhorter to help people and stand along beside them and bring them along in the Christian faith, you get them with the idea that they are dependent on you for the solutions and for the provision for their needs. And what they were talking about was a couple that wanted to move up to the North Woods. They have 3,000 acres that has been given to them, and that's where he goes to study. And he just gets away from the world up there. Man, couldn't you do that in 3,000 acres in Michigan? You know, tremendous place. And there was a couple that they wanted to move up there because more and more of their operation, to get away from the press and the clamor of people, they are there for periods of times. And this couple on their staff came and said, "Bill, we want to build a cabin, but we don't have the down payment." And he said, "You told them, well, let me think about that and pray about that." And immediately their expectation went up and they started looking to you to meet their need. You see? All right, now, there's so many, many times that we'll say to a person, "Well, let me, you know, boy, listen, let me help you about that. Let me do this for you." Instead of saying, "Listen, I don't know that I have the answer, but I believe that God does. Let's begin to pray and ask God for the answer to this thing, the provision for it, for the insight for it. And I know that this is my problem as a gift of service." I say, "Sure, I'll do that for you. Yeah, I'll help you out with this." Instead of saying, "Listen, I really don't know that I have the answer. Let's ask God about it. Let's believe that God has the answer." And then that's turning that person to God and making them and God have a relationship without me necessarily getting involved in it. You see the difference? And so here again is that thing of balance. You know, do I move into a person's life now, or do I let him hang himself first? And great is the hang thereof, you know, many times when this happens. Do I let that happen? And then I say this. So, you know, all the thing that we do is in working a person's life. Here might be a key to say, what should I do? And we ought to ask ourselves a question before we do something, saying, what will this develop in that person's life? Will it develop a dependence upon me? Or will it discourage him to the point that he'll never do it? What is this going to develop in his life in these days to come? And probably because we're afraid of mistakes, most of us do too much for people. We do too much for people without turning them back to God's Word, not simply saying, "Oh, brother, you got a problem, read the Bible." That's hogwash. You know, we've done that for so many years. Just pray and read the Bible. Pray about what? Read what in the Bible? Apply what in the Bible? See? And if you haven't worked through that thing and it's part of your life's testimony, you can't tell them what. Or if you can't say, "Hey, you got a real need in your life, let me plug you into this person." Now, here's something that I've come to do, Phil, more and more in my life. I look at people in my churches, in our church, in our fellowship, like resource books. And I tell them this. "Listen, you're God's resource library." And when some guy comes to me and says, "I've got a tremendous problem with moral freedom. I'm really striking out." And you would be flabbergasted, or maybe you wouldn't, because we're all human and we know one. How many seminary students come to me and say, "Man, listen, I am zero. I'm really having a struggle." And you know, instead of me doing it, I say, "Listen, I've got the neatest fella that worked through this in his life, and he counts this as a ministry. And I'll give you his name, and I'll phone him and tell him that you're going to phone him, and you all make your arrangements." You see? And I've got somebody else that's worked through financial freedom. Here, a guy, because we are so messed up. We're in debt up to our neck. We don't know what to do. And I say, "Listen, I've got this neat person." You see? And I use them like a reference library. I just pull that thing out and say, "Here's somebody that can help you." See? And so define these people. And people will love to share their ministry in this way. A fifth meaning, real quickly, is by ministering to the whole individual, to the total man. Now, so many times we're prone to the intellectual, and we're geared that way by our education and by the society in which we live. If I can just get his mind straightened out, if I can just get him thinking the right way, we're going to have it made. Now, my problem is not what I don't know. That's not my problem. My problem is, how do I appropriate what I know and put it into action in my life? And so it's not a matter of simple knowledge, but it's a matter of meeting that person's need, not simply on an intellectual basis, but an overall basis. Now, I've learned this, that when I deal with an individual and they come, I attack them, first of all, at their point of greatest resistance. Find out where they're resisting the will of God in their life. Find out where they're really caving in. And hit that thing head on. Here again, so much of my terminology is related to athletics, since I was in that for so long. And you know, a wise game plan many times will hit a team at their point of greatest resistance. And if they do that, brother, they've got them in their hand. That's their strength. You cave in a person's strength and you've got them, you see. So a lot of times we'll skirt things around and say, "Well, that's really a problem with you. Now, let's leave that here and let's go over and talk about something else." Listen, find out if it's a lack of submission to their parents. Hit that thing head on about submission. Not in a judgmental way, but in a confronting way, a discerning way from God's Word. Also, meet them at their point of deepest need. and greatest personal need. Well, now, listen, you got this problem. Now, sit down and let me take you through this thing. And I think Ralph or Barry or somebody was saying that earlier in the meeting. Don't go through a program. In other words, they might need that later on. Everybody needs to have a reaffirmation of the fundamentals. But start where they are, you see. Start where they are. And if self-image is a problem, start there. If moral freedom is a problem, start there. You know, find these needs in their lives and really get into that thing. Now, to minister to a total person, we just have to look at the life of Jesus. When we read about His development in chapter 2 of the Gospel of Luke in verse 52, we find what was so attractive about Jesus. First of all, Jesus increased in wisdom. Now, that's mental. He didn't assassinate his brains when he became a Christian. That's not the idea at all. All right. Second thing, he increased in stature. That's physical. You see, there are a lot of people, and I'm serious with you. One of the basic things they need is just a good exercise program to get their blood stimulated and get their hormones flowing and get all the things, get their body tuned up and their muscles, you know. It does an amazing thing just to your self-image and to your mind. Literally, you think better, you're clearer, you have more stamina if you have a physical activities program. And there's the physical thing. Some people, I had a fellow one time that was in our church. And when I came, he was our part-time youth director. He was heavy set, built about like I am, except much, much wider. He had a pair of wingtip shoes that had not been shined low in many years. They looked like he had worn them through the wilderness, brother. And his pants bagged, and he had a burr haircut, and he had a tremendous voice. His name was Wayne Bailey. And Wayne was known as, well, that's old Wayne, the youth director. The greatest delight was to look in his car. I'll tell you, you talk about... I never stuck my hand inside. I was afraid I'd get bit or contaminated. Man, there was everything in the world. You know, Whataburger wrappers, the last film from the youth thing that nobody had ever sent back, and books and football, baseballs. It was unbelievable. And that car was kind of a symbol of Wayne's life, you know. Literally, he went over 2 years and never cleaned it out. And it's got deeper and deeper and deeper. Boy, he'd get in and rummage around, you know, and throw all those things around. Well, when it came time to get a music director in our church, I had felt through that time that he was the fellow. Here's a guy that won the Metropolitan Opera auditions for the southwest part of the United States. Tremendous guy. And you know, when I sat down and talked to him about this and we fellowshipped and agreed that this was God's will, I said, Now, Wayne, let me share some things with you. I said, first of all, you need to shine your shoes. I said, you ought to shine your shoes. Make sure that you never go out unless your shoes are shined. You know, one of the first things that many people look at are your shoes. You say, they don't care about my shoes. Yes, they do. Yes, they do. I said, you need to, I would suggest, not because of any problem with hair, but for your image, for people to look at you as a man, I'd let your hair grow out. I'd eliminate the burr haircut. He didn't even have a suit. I said, you need to buy a suit. And you know, we just talked about things like that and personal things. And I said, he was a tremendous athlete. I said, you've let yourself really get away. You really need to lose some weight. Well, you know, that guy got into the program, did a fantastic job, and went to a large church in another state later on. And he told me several years later, he said, do you know that that was one of the greatest turning points of my life when you dealt with me about some physical things in my life? He knew that I wasn't critical. In other words, I wasn't judgmental, that I was discerning, and that the physical aspects are important. All right? So those are some things that we need. And in favor with God, increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God. And that's spiritual. And he needs that dimension in his life. And in favor with man, and that's socially. You know, one of the best received things that we've done in our church, and we're building a whole curriculum around it for young women and young married women, is a Christian charm course that includes hospitality, how to set a table, how to entertain people, how to create things. You know the NAVs, if any of you have been up there and their thing, they build their entire ministry to you at Glen Eyrie around hospitality. They have books printed about it. And they glorify God by meeting your needs without ever pushing on you. You never even see them, but they're always there, everything organized. They have a whole book, for instance, how to fold napkins. Did you know that? They do. They've got a whole book on creative ways of folding napkins and how to blend colors and how to do things inexpensively, you see, socially. We need to have that sort of social. And our women, we started out with a group of GAs in the summertime wanting to keep them together. And I suggested that I got the books and I said, here's something you ought to do with our GAs. And it involves the Christian Charm course. What it does is you simply take a picture of the individual, like measure them, the girl, and you put a picture in that thing, and it talks about every part of their grooming and their makeup and their physical posture and so forth and so on. And on the other page, for every physical characteristic you deal with, there is a spiritual characteristic that you deal with, so that you're developing both the physical and the spiritual. There's a book just like that for boys now. And we ran our boys through that. And you know, the women, the married women said, listen, we want a course like that. And so we had to come back in training union and run a course for young married women. And we had about 60 or 70 women in that thing. We brought in all kinds of people, Christian people with grace and charm to demonstrate these things. And they studied a physical attribute over against a spiritual attribute, not against, but along with that. Now, sixth thing, and I think we've about run out of time here, is it's conveying warmth and personal interest and concern. I believe that a leader is always a lover, and a lover is always a leader. There are some people that have a head full of knowledge, they've been to everything, but they just don't come across to people as being warm and approachable and lovable, as being human. And I've never seen an exception to that. Anyone who really is a leader at some level of his life will be a person that gives himself. He'll be loving. He'll be a person that will be what I call approachable. Approachable. And what is it? Okay, there's one other point in here somewhere. And that's, was that five or six? All right. And then a seventh one is you motivate people by eliciting specific commitments. And that's why we call the groups in our church accountability groups. I have learned that people do better under pressure. Now, I didn't say harassment or haranguing, but commitment. And this is why, for instance, Steve and I were talking this morning in our staff meeting, when I assign visitors out of that list that we keep, and then next week I say, hey, what happened in your visitation? And people on our staff said, listen, I need that. I need to know that I'm going to be accountable. It's required of a steward, what's the rest of it? That he be found faithful. And so many, many times we won't draw a commitment out of people. Ask people to make a commitment. Outline clearly. You know, this is why we don't get any more leaders than we do in church recruitment. Oh, listen, you can work with these kids. It doesn't take very much time, and it's really simple. You just need a certain number of hours, and it's really very simple. We keep saying that. It won't ask much of you. That's not right. We ought to outline exactly what will be asked of people and say, listen, this will require a definite commitment on your life. And to me, this is a very, very important thing. I never tell anybody in our church there's anything that is of no consequence. To me, every single job is of eternal consequence. And when we get a commitment from someone, so don't be afraid to put people on the spot. Now, and don't read them out when they don't commit themselves, see? Because they might not be at a point in their spiritual development where they're ready to commit things. And if you force them to make that commitment, then they're going to bomb out, and you've inoculated them against something, and they're really not going to come back with it and make the right kind of commitment. But just say, you know, that's between you and God, and I'm ready whenever you are. Leave yourself available where you can come back to that person. And they might come to you later on and say, listen, I'm ready to make that commitment now, you see. So be willing to put people on the spot. Be willing to really draw commitments out of people from time to time. Have you ever said something to a young person or to someone else? Say, well, listen, I'd really love to work with you, but you know, I don't believe you're ready yet. Why? Because they haven't been we're so anxious for leaders, but we need to send some people home. Isn't that what Jesus did? Sometimes he sent some people home, you see. And without being judgmental, just say, boy, listen, it's all ready. God's ready when you're ready. So these are things that we need to talk about.